I'm going to make a comparison of two varieties of reform in the 16th century. One was the liberal Catholic reform, and the other the Protestant reform inaugurated by Luther and continued by various other groups. These two reforms were headed by two men, the liberal Catholic reform by Erasmus of Rotterdam, and the Protestant reform in its initial stages, obviously, by Luther. So I'm going to make a comparison of these two men and take Erasmus tonight, and on Thursday evening compare Luther and Erasmus. There are two reasons for doing this. One is because of its relevance with reference to the discussions now going on between the Protestants and the Catholics. Erasmus, all along the line, wanted to keep the dialogue open and was very fearful that if diatribe supplanted dialogue, the end would be wars of religion. And, of course, it was. Whether it could have been otherwise is a matter of speculation. The other reason is to make a comparison between rival strategies of reform. Both Erasmus and Luther were agreed that there should be no physical violence. But Luther was very much more intemperate in his language. Erasmus wanted to keep the whole discussion on a moderate, gentlemanly level, without any vehement denunciation. And Luther said, "A breeze may bend a twig, but it takes a hurricane to uproot an oak." And Erasmus said to one of his friends, "Well, perhaps he's right." But for himself, Erasmus couldn't do it that way. So we have the two questions, the Catholic-Protestant question and the question of strategy. There was a liberal Catholic reform in the 16th century. A new word has lately been used for it, a French word, evangelism. To translate that as evangelism is rather confusing because we usually associate that with revivalism. Evangelism meant to go back to the evangel, to the gospel, to the New Testament. It was an attempt to reform the church by returning to its beginnings. There's a very interesting contrast here between that period and our generation, because today nearly all the reformers are saying we should be done with the past and go ahead with something new. In that period, the reformers all wanted to return to the past. However, they were in rebellion against an immediate past in favor of a still more remote past. In the field of religion, they would go back to the Bible, and in the case of Erasmus, particularly, the New Testament. Erasmus belonged also to a movement which was concerned to revive classical antiquity, and he really cared more for the classical preparation for the gospel than for the Jewish preparation. He was never fond of the Old Testament. It may have been because of the wars of the extermination of the Canaanites. It may have been because of the polygamy of the patriarchs. It may have been because he did not like the prophetic announcements, "Thus saith the Lord." He was never quite that sure about it. But on the classical side, he felt there was a preparation for the gospel, and he felt great sympathy for certain classical attitudes, all of them associated with the non-coercive, the gentle, magnanimity. Let not the victor be ruthless toward a conquered foe. Clemency, namely not exacting the pound of flesh. Harmony, concord. He believed the whole universe was pervaded with a rational principle, by reason of which the heavenly bodies were courteous to one another and did not collide in the heavens, and the sun would graciously give way to the moon, and so on. The whole cosmos was pervaded with the principle of a rational order. This is preeminently given to man as his endowment, and he should use it to compose his differences in a reasonable manner. These various concepts, and there were, well, I should mention others. There was the concept of natural law, that there is a law of nature which is superior to the law of states, and which one is to obey in the name of the higher versus the lower. These were some of the great classical concepts. He Christianized them as the early church had done. but he emphasized them, he resurrected them, and combined them with all the gentler virtues of the New Testament: humility, self-effacement, self-sacrifice, self-emptying, meekness, love, and patience. These were for him the preeminent, classical on the one side and Christian on the other side, the preeminent virtues. Erasmus proposed to effect this reform by education. He himself aspired to be not a teacher, but a teacher of teachers. He wrote a great many books which became standard texts in the schools of Europe and of the United States in the colonial period. They had a very long vogue. He desired to bring back to his generation the works of classical and biblical antiquity by discovering the manuscripts, determining accurately, if possible, the text, and then bringing out printed editions. No man worked harder than he to take advantage of the new technology, which was the printing press. All his life, he was running all over Europe from one place to another for manuscripts and printers, whether it was Oxford or Cambridge, London, Paris, Brussels, Antwerp, Venice, Rome, everywhere, manuscripts and printers. He said, if Ulysses was the wisest man in Greece because he visited so many cities, my horse is the wisest in Europe because he has attended so many universities. He traveled all the time by horse. In fact, that was the usual mode of travel. The rivers were not used very much. And I think it was probably because they did not have a rent-a-horse system. And when you got down the river, you wanted your horse, and he wasn't there. Of course, you could ship a horse on a barge, but not very many. There's one problem I haven't solved yet, and that is how they got the barges back up the Rhine. It's too zigzaggy for pulling along the side. Maybe they took them up on by horse and wagon. Well, that's another matter. Anyway, he was traveling all over the place. And in the interests of bringing out and making available again these lost treasures of antiquity, he was filled with a lyrical hope that a new era was about to dawn, an aetas aurea, a golden age in the church and in the world. And now for his biography. Erasmus was the illegitimate son of a priest. He had an elder brother who was in like situation. But it was not an unusual situation, because clerical concubinage was exceedingly widespread. We have complaints of it in Scotland, in Spain, in the Low Countries, in Switzerland. The attempt of the church to enforce clerical celibacy had ended in clerical concubinage, and the bishops simply charged a tax on the concubine and on the illegitimate children. Erasmus said they might be more willing to allow clerical marriage if they could put as heavy a tax on wives as they do on concubines. This particular circumstance accounts for much of his venom, almost you might say, against clerical and monastic celibacy. He said, I do not say that all priests and monks should get married, but I say it would be vastly better that they should be married than that so many boys should not be brought up by their fathers. And all that long before Luther. One person has said that Erasmus did more to undercut monasticism even than Luther himself. And of course, Erasmus also added, monasticism is not piety. It's not a way to heaven. It's a way of living. If you like it, all right. But it's just a way of living, that's all. His mother, of course, was in charge of the boys. The father was not irresponsible. He left some money for their care. They were sent to school at Deventer, which was the center of the Brethren of the Common Life. They were a new quasi-monastic order who at first took no lifelong vows, lived in residence, had all things in common, spent their time in devotional exercises and in teaching, and often planted their members in various schools around in Europe. Their chief representative was Thomas a Kempis, who wrote The Imitation of Christ. And the notes in that work run all through the works of Erasmus. The emphases in The Imitation of Christ are these. First of all, on a lyrical adoration of Jesus, there are prayers that simply burst into poetry. a devotion to the following in his footsteps, and particularly in the way of the Via Dolorosa, the way of suffering, and an aversion to overly refined theological speculation. Thomas A'Kempis said, "The Trinity is better pleased by adoration than by speculation." A favorite figure among the brethren of the common life was the penitent thief on the cross, because he was saved with so little theology. Christ said to him, "Today thou wilt be with me in paradise." Hadn't been baptized, never had the Lord's Supper, didn't know anything about transubstantiation or about homoousios and all of these other theological expressions, and yet Christ said he'd get to heaven. All he believed was that Christ could get him there. That was enough. So it's a minimal theology which they encouraged. A warm piety, a heartfelt commitment to the following of the humility and self-effacement of Christ, and an abstention from overly refined speculation. Erasmus was steeped in that tradition. But at the same time, he was very early versed in the classics, because although there were some among the brethren who were averse to classical studies, others had been affected by the new currents of the Renaissance and were willing to use the old pagan authors with discrimination, taking out of them particularly those passages in praise of moral virtue. And they could find much, of course, in Seneca, in Cicero, in the histories of Livy, and so on. Erasmus was very fond of these authors, and once ejaculated, "Sancte Socrata ora pro me," "Saint Socrates, pray for me." So very early he was working on the classical and on the biblical studies side by side. And as I indicated, the great program of his life began to emerge, that he would fuse again, as St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas had done in an earlier period, the classical and the Hebrew, the works of the great ancients. He would bring together the beauty that was Greece, the splendor that was Rome, and the grace of the gospel. Well, he was 16 years old. Of course, that depends a little on when he was born. Quite a debate is raging as to whether he was born in 1466 or 1469. And it is a matter of crucial importance in deciding when to have the celebration. The Swiss have decided on 1466, and they've had theirs. And the Dutch have decided on 1469, and so theirs is still coming. And as a good Erasmian, I'm going to bring out my biography in between. Next spring, I hope. Well, if he was born at the right time to make him 16, he was 16. Well, no, I believe he was 16 anyway. It would be the date that would be a variable, because he does say how old he was. So he was 16. We're all right on that. When he was 16... The question was, what next? His father and his mother had died in the plague when he was only 12. And the money which his father had left in charge of a guardian had been misinvested or something of the kind. It was all gone. And the guardian thought the best thing to do with a young man of literary taste was to make him a monk. But Erasmus stoutly resisted taking lifelong vows. And some of the brethren had yielded to pressure from the other orders and had introduced a branch with vows, and this was the branch he was urged to join. He resisted for quite a time, but finally he broke down and agreed to take the vows, and the reason was that the monastery that he would enter had a fine library. Luther went into the monastery to save his soul. Erasmus went into the monastery to get hold of a good collection of books. Well, he was in the monastery for about 6 years. On the whole, he got along fairly well with the brothers, though there were some ups and downs and there were some clashes, and I haven't got time for all that. But at the end of this period, his prior perceived that he was really not suited to the monastic life. He didn't like to get up at midnight to say his prayers. He said he couldn't go to sleep again. And he didn't like a diet of salt herring. He said it turned his stomach. And that was very unfortunate in Holland because they didn't have very much else. Oh, and he was Dutch, by the way. Erasmus of Rotterdam. And he didn't like fast days. He said fasting undermined his constitution so that he couldn't study very well. So there was always a certain amount of friction. He just didn't fit in. And the prior said, you know, you'd be better as a secretary to a bishop. So he got him a job of that kind. But Erasmus didn't like being anybody's secretary. And the bishop didn't have much for him to do. And he was a kindly man. He gave him a small stipend so that he could go and study at the University of Paris. He enrolled as a candidate for the degree of Doctor of Theology. And, of course, he went through the whole curriculum of the scholastic studies. The common assumption is that he had nothing but utter contempt for scholasticism. Well, he did satirize a number of features of scholasticism, but this is a mistaken judgment. If one reads all of his works, one discovers that he learned an enormous amount. He knew the scholastics up and down. He could just quote them all up and down the centuries. When he wrote a treatise on marriage, he could tell you what everybody had thought on it from the New Testament, St. Paul and St. Jerome and St. Augustine all down the line. He knew a great deal about it. And he did not treat them with universal contempt. But there were many subjects which they were debating which ill comported with the advice of Thomas a Kempis to adore instead of to speculate. Erasmus said they made him think of a mythological figure, Epimenides by name, who was said to have gone to sleep for 36 years, except that he did wake up. But as for these scholastics, they were debating questions like this. Could God, had he so desired, have become incarnate, not in the man, Jesus Christ, but in a donkey or a pumpkin? Erasmus would say. What a silly thing for anybody to be talking about. For him, the tests of theology were piety and morals. That doctrine is a good doctrine, which makes people devout and disposed to adore, and makes them devoted and committed. Piety and morals, these are the tests. But he did perceive, and later brought it out, that this question was part of a whole series of questions which center around the problem of the power of God. If God is omnipotent, if he can do absolutely anything, can he make black white? Can he make true false? Can he make the past not to have been the past? Can he do something preposterous like becoming incarnate in a donkey or a pumpkin? It was a part of this whole set of questions. The feeling of Erasmus was that absolute power corrupts even God. Absolute power is incompatible with morality. There must be limitations on power if there can be morality. Otherwise, right can be made wrong, true can be made false, and so on all down the line. There must be certain self-limitations imposed on God by his very nature as good. And there are therefore some things that God cannot do. This became plain in later discussions. As to the thought of Erasmus, it was not merely that this was an unnecessarily provocative and disturbing question. He didn't like the way it was put. But with regard to the question itself, he lined up all down the line saying no, 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 no to all of these propositions which would emancipate God from the rules of logic and morality. God must be good. Well, he'd been working in Paris for about 6 years, and the bishop thought it was about time he took his doctor's degree. He was afraid he was going to become a perpetual graduate student. So he cut him off. But Erasmus wasn't ready yet. The only way he could go on was by private tutoring. So he began to take in students. Best thing that ever happened to him, because it led him to begin composing those educational works which were to become the textbooks of Europe. I'd love to have time to give examples from the various works that he composed, but we can't do that. They're not too pertinent to our immediate purpose. Every one of them had a little barb, a little touch of his own personal way of saying things. But the other thing that came out of this teaching relationship was an invitation to go to England. One of his pupils was an Englishman, Lord Mountjoy, a nobleman, a man of wealth. Young man, he invited Erasmus to come as his guest, and Erasmus went. He was thoroughly charmed with England. He wrote to a friend in Paris and said, "This is a delightful country, and there is nothing that is more exquisitely charming than their custom of kissing each other wherever they meet. If you could see these angelic damsels, I'm sure you'd fly over from Paris even if you had the gout." One must remember that Erasmus was writing to a friend who was a gay blade, and nobody had more of a capacity of adapting himself to the tastes of his correspondents than Erasmus. But he didn't stay long at the country estate of his friend. We find him very quickly at Oxford, engaged in serious studies, and staying with the order to which he belonged, the monastic order. So he hadn't broken with them at all. But now he came in contact with a very remarkable group of young men, among whom was Thomas More, the author of The Utopia, now St. Thomas More. Colette, later the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, was another, and I could go through half a dozen, but these names will suffice. Sufficient to say that they were men of ability, in the case of More, affability, charm, wit, playfulness. He was a bit of a tomboy on occasion, with a deep strain of piety. In later life, he wore a hair shirt beneath his robes of office, for he was the chancellor of the realm. Colette, a man deeply committed to the reform of the church, very outspoken. When Henry VIII was about to engage in a war on the continent, Colette preached such a sermon against war that the king was pretty dubious as to whether the morale of his troops would be wrecked. Here were men of ability, of substance, of good families, of integrity, who were willing to throw it all away for what they believed, as they later proved. It was an enormous stimulus to Erasmus to emerge into a circle of men of like tastes, of deep commitment, and with the same faith in the possibility of restoring the church and the whole of society. You get the program of it later in Thomas More's Utopia, on which Erasmus collaborated. But he also got a new outlook from these men, and they derived it from Italy. Erasmus was Italianized before he went to Italy by reason of these Englishmen. Colette had been there. More hadn't, but More had studied Italian and had translated a work of Pico della Mirandola. Now, Pico, P-I-C-O, was the leader of the academy in Florence for the revival of the study of Plato and the Neoplatonists. Their ideas were very popular with More and with Colette, and presumably through them, Erasmus became inducted into this philosophy. The primary point at which he was affected was this: in the view of the body, man's corporeal attribute. For the Neoplatonists said not that the body is bad fundamentally as such, but nevertheless it is inferior to the spirit. The spirit is imprisoned in the body, and the life of the spirit consists in emancipating oneself from all the things of the flesh, of sight and sound and sense, until all the material world vanishes from consciousness and one is wrapped in ecstasy in union with the ineffable one. This is the Neoplatonic ecstatic vision. Now, you can easily combine that with Christianity, because in the New Testament, and particularly in Paul, we have the contrast between the flesh and the spirit. Though for Paul, the flesh is not the corporeal part of man, it's whatever wars against the spirit. Malice, contention, these are all of the flesh, and they're not corporeal. But you've got the expression, flesh and spirit, letter and spirit. The things that are seen are temporal. The things that are unseen are eternal. There's the contrast between the visible and the invisible, the temporal and the eternal. All of these expressions are in Neoplatonism, but they're all given a tinge of the corporeal on one side and the incorporeal on the other. Now, the effect of that can be, in Christianity, to regard either as an impediment, or at any rate, as unnecessary, all of the external aids to religion. To give up pictures, statues, crucifix, music, even the sacrament, for it's bread and wine, and these are physical, and to insist that God is to be worshipped without any external aids, purely in the spirit. For the flesh profits nothing, the spirit gives life, as we read in the 6th chapter of John, and that was the favorite text with the people who took this attitude. One could abolish all these. Erasmus was never willing to do so. He said we must show consideration for the weak. In the lower stages of religion, these practices may be of some help. They do not necessarily preclude a devout attitude. And as we arise in the spiritual ladder, they become superfluous and will drop away of themselves. There's no need to have any radical smashing of images and organs and so on. But when the ideas of Erasmus passed to other people, Uli Zwingli, the organs were disposed of in Zurich, and the Lord's Supper became only a memorial, and the music was given up altogether, and the images and the pictures were all taken out, but they overlooked the stained glass windows. In other words, you've got a line here that leads to Puritanism. It's a strange thing that the Catholic liberal Reformation of the 16th century had more effect on the more radical aspects of Protestantism than did Luther, who was more of a Catholic in this regard than Erasmus, because Luther loved the liturgy, the music, the pictures, the real presence. He said flesh and spirit cannot be dissociated. God has not divided them, and who is man to put them apart? So here is a radical difference in their approach, and I think it's the Neoplatonic element which leads to it in Erasmus. Well, he stayed in England for a while, then he went back to the continent, and there he wrote a little tract which was to have an enormous vogue called The Dagger of the Christian Soldier. The title in Latin is Enchiridion Militis Christiani. Enchiridion comes from the Greek, en and her, a hand, chiropody comes from it. In the hand. Well, that can mean a little weapon, a dagger, or a little book, a handbook. So sometimes you'll find this translated, the handbook of the Christian soldier, and sometimes the dagger of the Christian soldier. But since it deals with a military metaphor all the way through, I think dagger is really a better translation. He wrote this tract at the request of a woman whose husband, a manufacturer of armaments in the Low Countries, was a pretty loose fellow. And he had no use for theologians except me, said Erasmus. So the wife was hoping that Erasmus could do something with him and suggested that he write a little manual for his benefit. I wrote, said Erasmus, The Dagger of the Christian Soldier, and I gave it to him, and he replied by giving me his own dagger, and neither made any use of the weapon of the other. For Johann von Papenreuther did not mend his ways. But The Dagger of the Christian Soldier did become immensely popular. It was in Latin, of course. Everything Erasmus wrote was Latin. He could talk Latin better than his native Dutch. And you must remember that in the 16th century, you could go anywhere on Latin. All the way from Scandinavia to Spain, among educated men, you could talk Latin. Albrecht Dürer could go up to Krakow in Poland and talk Latin. Erasmus just knew a smattering of the vernaculars, although he was five times in England, and couple of years in Italy, didn't learn Italian. Latin sufficed. But his Latin works were translated into all the vernaculars of Europe. And when you look at a bibliography of the works published in Poland in the 16th century, you'll find a number of translations from Erasmus. And many of the works in the 16th century were translated into English, into German, into French, into Italian, etc., etc., and so on and so on. He was widely translated, and The Dagger of the Christian Soldier became one of the most popular of his works. It is a plea for inwardness in religion. He is inveighing continually against saying prayers by rote, for Christ said, "You're not to be heard for your much babbling," against leaving your family and going off on a pilgrimage to St. James at Compostela, be better if you stayed home and look after your responsibilities, of concern for collecting the relics of the saints. Frederick the Wise was a great collector of relics, went to the Holy Land to collect them. Luther also made fun of that. He made fun of those who had feathers of the Holy Ghost and eggs of the Holy Ghost and some of the notes that Miriam beat on her drum and some of Absalom's hair and so on. Well, Erasmus poked an awful lot of fun at relics. He said, "You stare at a bone of one of the saints or the Apostle Paul in a glass case, but you never see his spirit shining through his writings. Let us be done then with these externals, and let us by stages arise from all the things of sense until we are wrapped in union with the invisible." It's the Neoplatonic ecstasy with which he concludes. So here then is his plea for the interior, heartfelt, devout piety over against the external, which is concerned to win external benefits, and rattles off prayers without paying any attention to what they're all about. He said, "You know, I knew one dear old priest." He was a dear old priest. But he used to say, "Our Father who art in heaven," to the Virgin Mary. He says, "You ought to pay some attention to whom you're praying to." Externality, not having your mind on it, all of that kind of thing, he pillories to a degree, and then ends up with this plea for a simple and heartfelt devotion. Then came a chance to go to Italy. He had long wanted to go to Italy, but the opportunity had not come. But now there was a physician to the King of England, an Italian, il dottore Boerio, who had two boys. He wanted them to go to the University of Bologna and wanted some older person to go along and supervise their studies, expenses all paid, and offered the opportunity to Erasmus, who accepted very gladly. They went straight for Bologna, the great university city. And they arrived at Bologna just as the city was captured by the Pope himself at the head of his armies. Pope Julius II, Giuliano il Secondo, Giuliano il Terribile, the terrible Julius. He was like any of the princes of the Renaissance, magnificent, virile, a man of terrific capacity. He discovered Bramante, Raffaele, Michelangelo. It was for his tomb that Michelangelo did the Moses. He started the St. Peter's, the present St. Peter's. But he was determined at the same time to build up the estates of the church. Because earlier in the Middle Ages, the papacy had ruled over a section of Italy, running from Rome over the Apennines to Ravenna. But various northern Italian cities had encroached upon this territory. Bologna had taken a chunk, and Ferrara, and Venice. And Julius resolved that he would recover all of this territory. He would restore the estates of the church. He organized his own army. He led his own army. And he conquered the city of Bologna. And then on the following day, he had a great triumphal procession. White stallions leading, the cardinals marching, all the princes of the church, all of the secular rulers, and the Pope himself, carried aloft upon the shoulders of his soldiers to the church where they blessed God for this signal victory. "I groaned," said Erasmus. Julius the Second playing the part of Julius Caesar. And when Erasmus went out to the countryside and saw the papal tax collectors taking away a peasant's only cow, He felt that all the whole thing that lay back of it all was simply extortion. Then he went to Rome. Already he was a man of reputation. Cardinals received him very graciously, put their libraries at his disposal. He was very much flattered. He never minded courtesies from the great. But somebody invited him to go to a bullfight in the papal palace. And Julius II actually staged bullfights. The way they did it was to form a cordon of soldiers with their spears pointed in like this to contain the bull. They didn't have any amphitheater. And then they had the bullfight inside that enclosure. Sometimes they use a wooden barricade. Erasmus describes a similar situation in Siena. Now, said Erasmus, first of all, they had the bullfight. And when the bull had been dragged out, then a man came in and gave a pantomime of a bullfight. It was no bull, you understand. The man had the cape around his arm, and he had his sword, and he came in all by himself, and he points this at the bull, and the bull charges at him, and he flings his cape over in this direction to divert the bull. The bull goes after it, finds that the man is not there, then gradually retreats, and the man goes over very gingerly and picks up his cape and comes back to his original position. And then he again points his sword, and the bull again charges, and he jumps into the place of safety, and he gets the bull going round and round and round and round in a circle until the bull is absolutely breathless, and then he jumps on his back and crows in triumph. I enjoyed this pantomime a great deal more than the gory sport, is the comment of Erasmus. And that is Erasmian. He hated brutality, whether it was to men or to beasts. But now came a letter from England, from his old friend Lord Mountjoy. Come to England, the golden age is dawning. That marvelous young Prince Henry has become Henry VIII. You can't imagine how much enthusiasm there was for Henry VIII at the beginning of his reign. He was a handsome young man, a fine athlete, interested in theology, already sufficiently trained to reply to Martin Luther as he did later on. A patron of learning. Oh, they thought now the scholars are going to have their turn and the new learning will be universally introduced. The aurea itas has come. Come back to England. The king wants you. He's written you in his own hand. Archbishop Warren will give you a living for your support. Erasmus said he didn't like the idea of having a living from a church that he couldn't serve and he couldn't talk English, but the archbishop said, your services to Christendom are so great that it's worth taking part of the income of a church to maintain you to carry on your work. So Erasmus started for England. He rode horseback, of course, and that gave him a chance to think. There's a point in riding horseback. It probably took him about 3 weeks to get to England. When he arrived, he was a bit done up. And he went to the home of Thomas More. And there he put down what he had been ruminating on the way and entitled it with a pun. He called it the Encomium Moriae, the praise of Moria. Well, this was almost the name of More, the praise of More, an encomium on More. But Moria in Greek also means foolishness, folly. The praise of More, the praise of folly. In this little skit, folly comes in, clad with cap and bells, mounts a rostrum to give a lecture, says that she will pay no attention to the rules of the rhetoricians, and then composes her discourse exactly in line with the rules of the rhetoricians. She begins by saying that she is a very great benefit to the human race. In fact, without her, the human race would be extinct. Because, said she, if people calculated how much trouble it is to have a baby, they'd never have one. And if they'd had one, they'd never have another. But folly carries them along. And so folly keeps the race going. So I am responsible for the whole human race, says folly. Then her character shifts. And that's the elusiveness of this track. You can't quite tell who folly is. Now she becomes downright foolishness. And then he goes through all the list of the abuses, the over-refinements of the scholastic theologians, the wars that are made by Christian princes against each other, the attitude of nobles who despise a butcher but don't mind carving up a stag in the chase, the Franciscans who will wear cowls so filthy that a ship's captain wouldn't put it on in a storm, and then think they can go up to heaven and present themselves in these filthy rags and demand to be rewarded by Christ, and scholars who ruin their eyes and destroy their health prematurely, pondering over old books like that Erasmus. He mentions himself. He's the only person he names. When the Pope read it, he laughed. He said, well, I'm glad he put himself in anyway. But now, who is talking now? Is Erasmus really thinking that all of his scholarship is to be compared to the attitude of these friars, these nobles, these kings? Folly shifts again. She's already halfway shifting. She becomes the foolishness of God, who chooses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty, who makes use of crosses and persecutions to overcome the world. Now, in another work, Erasmus had a commentary on the verse, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. And the list of things that he calls vanity is just about the same list that he has in the Praise of Folly. But when he gets through, he says, well, shall we then have nothing to do with any of it? Of course, some of it is downright foolishness. But shall we have nothing to do with politics, with business, with marriage, with scholarship? No. We shall participate as if not participating. We shall be in the world as if not of the world. Habentes tamquam non habentes, having as if not having, as the Apostle Paul said, remembering that we are but pilgrims traveling to another city whose builder and maker is God. I think the Praise of Folly is an ironic version of the contempt of the world, a familiar medieval theme, but it's done this time with subtlety and irony. Well, he stayed on several years in England, worked at Cambridge, laid the foundation for the great biblical work that was coming later, and then he had to leave England. The reason was that England had become involved in war with France. That glorious young Prince Henry had embarked on a foreign war. And he was bleeding the English nobility to support the war, and many of them had to go over there and participate. The patrons of Erasmus were unable to keep up the help which they had been supplying to him. He went back to Holland. But then in the year 1513, I ought to explain what this war was all about. England went to war against France to help France in a war against Venice. Now, wait a minute. England went in to oppose France. France was supporting Venice, helping her against Pope Julius, who was now trying to do to Venice what he had done to Bologna. So, here is Henry opposing France. France is helping Venice. The Pope is fighting Venice, which means that England is supporting Pope Julius. That Pope whom he so detested is now being supported by that glorious young prince who was to have ushered in the golden age. Well, in the year 1513, the Pope died. And then there came out a dialogue with nobody's name on it, entitled Julius Exclusus, Julius Excluded from Heaven. It's a dialogue between Pope Julius and St. Peter. And the Pope has a little companion at his side. The Pope comes up to the gate of heaven and he gets out his big key. And he says, what the devil? His companion says, maybe you got the wrong key. No, he says, the key of power. It used to work on earth. Well, Peter hears this rattle, and he comes and looks over the gate, and he says, whew, who are you? And the Pope points to his chest, on which he has the letters P.M. P.M. Can't you read? Pontifex Maximus. Pestis Maxima. A big pest, says Peter. Well, who are you to talk to me, says the Pope. You're only a Jew. I'm a Ligurian Italian. Oh, you are. Why do you care what country you belong to? Well, I want my country to have the credit of me. Well, now, tell me what you've done that I should let you in. Have you said any prayers? Well, that isn't my job. Have you worked any miracles? Well, miracles are out of date. Well, what have you done? I captured Bologna. You did? Well, what for? Was Bentivoglio a tyrant? No. Heretic? No. What then? I wanted it for my son. Popes with wives and sons? No, you don't understand. Sons, not wives. Well, now tell me a little more. What have you done? Why, I made the papacy great. It's magnificent. You ought to see our processions. Horses prancing, boys dancing, dishes steaming, bugles blowing, drums beating, and I carried aloft in magnificence and the emperor kissing my feet. It's marvelous. Didn't have anything like that in my day. Well, the job wasn't worth having in your day. We conquered by suffering, persecutions, stripes, imprisonment, exile, and death. Then you're not letting me in? You wait till next year till more of my soldiers die and we'll knock your gates down. Did Erasmus write that? He did not say flatly, "I did not write that." He said, "How would anybody think I would do such a thing?" But we know there was a manuscript in his own handwriting because Thomas More says so. Now, of course, he might have copied it, but it's not very likely because he had a secretary to copy his own work. And More wrote a defense, pointing out all the reasons why it wasn't likely that Erasmus would do it, and then concluded, "But suppose he did?" And then there was another poem, which was even more stinging, which made a minute comparison between Pope Julius and Julius Caesar, and ended by saying, "There is only one point lacking in the comparison, namely, another Brutus." Now, the authorship of that poem was in doubt until about 2 years ago, when a copy was found in the handwriting of Erasmus. I can't go into all the details of the controversy about this authorship, but it looks to me as if the evidence is very, very strong in favor of the Erasmian authorship. And there's one other point that I came across, that when he was commenting on the Gospels, the triumphal entry of Jesus, he says, "Look at our lowly Lord riding upon the donkey. Look upon the Jewish high priest riding on a stallion. Horses dancing, boys prancing, and wearing the tiara." Well, where did the Jewish high priest ever wear any tiara? It's almost word for word out of this dialogue and applied to the Jewish high priest. The English translation says in the margin, "Here he covertly attacketh the Roman pontiff." Well, it's not, there's nothing very covert about it. But this wasn't all he was doing. He was writing on political subjects, a manual on the education of the Christian prince for Charles, who was later Charles V, another tract on politics for Philip, the father of Charles, a tract called The Complaint of Peace, which is one of the classics of the world's peace literature. Peace is personified. She wanders up and down the earth and none will receive her. She expects that The philosophers will receive her, but they're quarreling. The theologians are worse. Even within a city, there are factions. She approaches a family, and there's more peace there than there is anywhere else. But even there, the husband and wife are not in entire accord. And even within the breast of a single individual, the soul and the passions are at war. And it's very strange. For the Old Testament predicts that swords shall be beaten into plowshares, and Jesus said, "My peace I give unto you." Who's responsible for all this? Not the laity, the clergy. And canons are actually given the names of the apostles. It was true, Henry VIII had cast 12 bronze canons, each with the names of one of the apostles. And think of the wickedness of it. Men who are locked up in peacetime can be used very well in war. The cost of it, what it takes to besiege a city until it surrenders, would enable one to go and build a new one. The uncertainty of it, who can tell how it will turn out? And the folly of it, for man is only the creature of a summer's day, and why should he be in such haste to destroy himself? What then is the answer? He doesn't call for a restoration of the empire, nor for the ending of national states. His political program is really isolationism. Let each one be content with what it has and pay attention to internal affairs. But above all else, let us be done with these cries of a Frenchman and an Englishman as natural enemies. The channel may separate the English and the French, but it cannot separate those who are united in the love of Christ. The Pyrenees divide the French and the Spaniards, but not those who are brothers in the Lord. The Rhine separates the French and the Germans, but not those who have been redeemed by grace. Let us then bind up discord with adamantine chains, which never shall be broken. That's the conclusion of this tract. He was also working on editing the Fathers. St. Jerome brought out a great edition of the Letters of Jerome with a new biography. And then, and this was his greatest achievement, as it seems to me, the edition for the first time in history of the New Testament in the original Greek in print in Basel at the Press of Froben in 1516. Now, it was not very careful work. Erasmus said precipitated rather than edited. He put out 5 editions during his lifetime. He was always trying to get more manuscripts. He had only a few at his disposal at Basel, and none of them earlier than, I think, the 12th century. He did not have the Vaticanus, which was in Rome, and he wasn't in Rome at the time, though he got a friend to look up some readings. It was a hasty piece of work, to be sure, but nevertheless, very significant, because now it was entirely possible for each scholar to have at least a text of the New Testament in Greek in front of him. Furthermore, to have the book in print facilitated collation. It was a hard thing to bring manuscripts together into one place. You might lose them. Bring a manuscript from Alcala and take it over to Rome, or vice versa, or Vienna. But you could send a printed book, and then you could have all the variants put in the margin and send the book back to the central place, and if it got lost, you could do it with another copy. So it greatly facilitated collation. The greatness of his work, however, also consisted in his annotations, in which he called attention to the problems of the text, the problems of translation, and so on. He shocked his generation because he left out a number of well-known texts, and the chief one was 1 John 5:7. There are 3 on earth that witness, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and there are 3 in heaven that witness, the Father, the Logos, and the Spirit. Tres marturuntes ente gay, haima huma caidor, tres ento urno pater logos cae hagien pneuma. He couldn't find that in any Greek manuscript. He could find the first part of it. There are 3. It didn't say on earth. There are 3 that witness, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. That was all. Not on earth, and the contrast within heaven. It was in the Vulgate. But it was not in any of his Greek manuscripts. Then he went back to the Church Fathers, and that's a part of his contribution, because he realized that the Church Fathers wrote at a time much earlier than any of the manuscripts that he had. So if he could find a quotation from the Bible in St. Jerome or St. Augustine or St. Hilary or St. Ambrose or some other of the early fathers, he knew what reading that church father had nearly 1,000 years earlier than the manuscripts he had. So he made much use of patristic evidence with regard to the text. Well, he found that St. Cyril did not have this in Greek in the East, and that Bede, the Saxon, did not have it in Latin in the West. Consequently, he left it out. There was a huge cry, and they said, "You don't believe in the Trinity." I said, "Yes, I do, but I'm telling you, this verse isn't there, that's all." He said, "If you can find it in a single manuscript, I'll put it in." Well, they did. And he suspected it was manufactured for the purpose. And we now know that it was. It was done at Oxford, to Oxford's eternal shame. True to his word, he put it back in, but with a footnote to say that the evidence in its favor was very slight. Well, now, why did he give in to the storm? Was it simply cowardice? No, I think the reason was this. It was in the Vulgate. Now, he argued that St. Jerome wouldn't have made it up. It must have been in the Greek that was in front of St. Jerome. Therefore, there must have been a discrepancy with regard to the text in the 4th century. Since Cyril and Bede did not have it, and Jerome did have it. What Erasmus did not know was that this text does not appear in the Vulgate until the 8th century. So before you can use the Church Fathers or a translation as evidence for the text, you've got to have the correct text of the Church Father or of the translation. And that's one of the reasons why he spent much of his life editing the various Church Fathers and trying to get their text correctly. Luther worked from the edition of 1519, which didn't have this. So the Germans have not been corrupted by this bad text. But it went into Tyndall and the other English versions and the King James. It's not in the Revised Standard Version. Pope Leo XIII pronounced it genuine, but a commission of Catholic scholars a short time ago pronounced it spurious, and it's now the universal consensus that this verse is not genuine. Well, there were other verses too, but this is enough to illustrate that point. After the determining of the text, then came the translation. And Erasmus made a new translation into Latin to replace the Vulgate, at least for private use. He said, "I wouldn't interfere with it in church. In the reading of the liturgy, you can use the Vulgate, but certainly the scholar should have an accurate translation." Some said to him, "What do you make a new translation for? Hasn't the church used St. Jerome's translation for the last 1,000 years and more? And the decisions of popes and councils are based upon it? You're going to wreck the whole church. Everything will be in confusion." "Well," said Jerome, "my New Testament's been out for a few years, and everything isn't in confusion yet." This was in a later edition that he said that. He furthermore said that when you translate, you must understand the Greek of the New Testament, and you must remember it's not the Greek of Demosthenes. "Do you mean to say that the Greek written by the authors of the New Testament wasn't as good as the Greek of Demosthenes?" said John Eck. "The apostles, when they were given the gift of tongues by the Holy Ghost?" "Oh," said Erasmus, "if you look over the list of languages of which the Holy Ghost gave the apostles command at Pentecost, you'll find the Greek wasn't one of them." So then he proceeded to make a new translation, and whereas the Vulgate had, instead of "repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand," "do penance," he translated it simply, "be penitent," and Luther picked that up immediately. And in place of, "In the beginning was the Word, in principio erat verbum, he said "sermo," and they attacked him on that and said he was denying the incarnation. He said, "No, I'm not. But verbum means a word, this word, that word, and the other word. Sermo means connected, meaningful discourse, eloquence. Christ is the eloquence of God. This is his unique title. He is the sermo. We must preach the sermons." Then he proceeded, and just one more point, to interpret the Bible by putting out paraphrases. of the Pauline epistles first, and then of the Gospels. He had started on Romans and then dropped it. When he was traveling from Ghent to Basel with his groom, each on horseback, and when they got about 6 miles out of Ghent, Erasmus' horse shied and wrenched his back so that he couldn't even get off. Well, his groom got him down, and then he couldn't get back up again and couldn't think of walking. So Erasmus said, "I prayed to the Apostle Paul, and I said, if he'd get me out of this, I would complete my paraphrase on his epistle to the Romans. And thereupon I was able to remount and was speedily cured, and I praise God and the Apostle." Well, my own opinion is, if the Apostle had known what he would do with Romans, he would have made him walk. For he did take the edge off predestination. But of that next time. These paraphrases had an enormous popularity. There was a decree in England under Edward VI that his paraphrases of the Gospel in English translation should be in every church in England alongside of the Bible. And they went into many other languages likewise. And I'll give you only one or two samples of the way in which he treats the Scriptures. He has the story of the man who was cured of blindness partway to begin with, and saw men as trees walking. And he said, "Ah, that one is a sycamore, and that one is a cypress, and that one is a cedar, and that one is an olive. But when his eyes were fully opened, they were cut down to their real size." Then he tells the story about the man who was brought, the man sick of the palsy, brought by four of his friends, and they found such a throng around Jesus in a house that they couldn't get in. So, as you know, they went up on the roof and made a hole and let him down. And Erasmus said, "Just think of that. Jesus has a little group around him, and he's talking to them, and they're drinking it in, when all of a sudden there's a hole in the roof, and rubble comes down. Why, you'd think the owner of the house would have been outraged, and Jesus would have been indignant to have this miserable sick man drop right down in front of him." But he doesn't rebuke anybody. He shows no irritation. He has compassion, and he heals him. It's the tenderness of the Gospel that Erasmus stresses. And then Mary and Martha. He said, "Our Lord was deeply touched by the concern of both of the sisters. Martha was fussy and running around and everything. And she wanted Mary to come and help her, but she knew there was no use saying anything to Mary, because Mary was so entranced by Jesus, she wouldn't leave him. So she practically blamed Jesus and said, 'You shouldn't be so delightful that you're keeping her here. You must tell her to come and help me, because I've got to get the dinner.' And Jesus said, 'Martha, I very much appreciate all that you're doing for the entertainment of me and of my disciples. I do know that household preparations have to be made. But after all, the spirit is more important than the body, and that is my mission, and Mary has chosen the better part.' And so we see what a kindly answer Jesus gave to both of the sisters and granted to each her due. And finally, the prodigal son. And when he came to himself, he arose. And he said, 'I will go to my father and say, Father, I have sinned before heaven and before thee, and am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thine hired servants.' And he arose. And while he was yet a long way off, his father saw him. He who had the greater love did first espy the other. And the father ran. And the boy had only just started his little speech when the father cut him off, threw his arms about his neck and kissed him, and called for the ring and the robe and the fatted calf. Now this is a picture of the mercy of God." Well, here then is Erasmus. This was 1516. Luther's theses came out the next year, 1517. Erasmus in 1516 was 50 years old, I'm assuming the earlier date. He probably had more friends in high circles than any man in Europe. Francis I in his own hand had invited him to Paris. Henry VIII had been glad to have him in England. The Emperor Charles had made him one of his counselors. The Emperor Ferdinand wanted him in Vienna. Several popes had invited him repeatedly to come to Rome. The universities vied with one another to attract him. Ximenes tried to get him to Spain. There was no man who enjoyed a more universal European reputation, nor had so many friends in high circles as Erasmus of Rotterdam. But when Luther's theses were posted on the castle door at Wittenberg, a chain of events was introduced, the issue of which was that Erasmus was to become one of the most reviled of men in Europe. And I'll deal with that on Thursday night.